නමෝතස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ. නමෝතස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ. නමෝතස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ. Dear friends in Dhamma, actually we were discussing Upakkilesa Sutta, which is available in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the third book of Majjhima Nikaya. And here, interestingly, Buddha talks about certain deficiencies, certain obstacles that one can have to the samadhi, to the concentration. Actually, the series of sermons that we were delivering last few weeks are much related to the samadhi, concentration. And this is also fairly related to concentration. And by the way, the Sutta does not immediately start talking about samadhi, but rather it talks about very interesting incident happened around the Sangha. The two groups of Sangha were divided and they were talking, or rather arguing each other related to a Vinaya issue, a disciplinary activity, and then it went on for a long time, and then they start even sort of using some harsh words and hitting each other, quarreling each other, and ultimately the news came to the Buddha, and Buddha tried to settle the thing, settle the conflict, but the monks were not even listening to the Buddha. And after that, Buddha gave various instructions so that the monk would realize their fault, but unfortunately they continuing the quarrel. So then Buddha decided to leave. So after Buddha left, the Goshitarama in the Kosambi, so first he came across one another venerable. He is living alone and he is called Bhagu, and he is actually at a particular place called Balaka Lonakara. So at that place, Venerable Bhagu was living in that particular village, and Buddha met him, and Buddha was asking his situation, and he mentioned he is doing well and he is actually living alone, and Buddha advised him actually, and then sort of encouraged him in the practice. And then Buddha left, and now he arrived another place which is called where a kind of a bamboo park is available, where three monks are staying. So those three monks are well-known monks, Venerable Anuruddha, Venerable Nandiya, and Venerable Kimbila. So those are the monks staying at that particular place. They are doing really well, and they were actually practicing really well, and they are really helpful to each other. And as a result of that, the person who was looking after the park, as the park keeper, didn't even allow Buddha to go in because he was thinking that whoever coming in may be a distraction, may be a hindrance, an obstacle to these three monks. And as a result of that, he didn't even allow Buddha to go in. And anyway, Venerable Anuruddha heard the discussion, and he immediately came to the scene, and then he accompanied the Buddha, and he asked other two monks also to help. And they also came, and one took the bowl, one took the robes, and one prepared the seat, one washed the feet. So likewise, all the typical hospitality is shown to the Buddha. And then Buddha was discussing with them, and Buddha particularly asked how they are doing, whether they are harmonious, living peacefully, and they all say they all are doing really well. Basically, they are mentioning very interesting point that we discussed last time also. They are without any disputes, without any kind of conflicts, and with mutual appreciation, and blending like milk and water, weaving each other with kindly eyes. So this is something very, very interesting, because when someone is living in a group, in a community, so it is sometimes not easy, because we individually may have our own ideas, own views, and we may be trying to enforce them. And in that situation, the peace among the community can have kind of an impact. So here very interesting point Venerable Anuruddha mentioned. He mentioned that he set aside what he wish and do what these other venerables wish to do. So basically he is trying to leave his ego and his own ideas, his own kind of views, and he is trying to abide by the others' views, others' ideas. So that is very difficult in a way if we have a strong ego, because if one has a strong ego, basically that person is trying to influence others, always wanting others to follow him. He wants to be the leader. So that is how typically things happen when someone is having a very strong ego. But here Venerable Anuruddha mentioned the opposite. So he basically doesn't want to influence others, impose any of his own ideas. Rather, he likes to stay cordially, peacefully with others, so that he can put aside his own ideas, but he can abide by others' ideas. And he interestingly mentioned that they are different in body, but they are one in mind. So Buddha actually praised him, and he discussed about the other two as well. The other two, Venerable Nandiya and Venerable Kimbila, they too mentioned the same thing. Now after hearing all these good news, Buddha now asked about their practice. And now Venerable Anuruddha is trying to develop what you call the clairvoyance, the Dibbachakku. So as a result of that, still he is unable to prepare it, unable to generate it. Still some hindrances are there, some problems are there. So as a result of that, he is facing some issues. So he is now explaining his difficulties to the Buddha. And he mentioned sometimes he has the vision, but there is no enough light available. Sometimes he has light, but the forms are not visible. Sometimes both are not enough. So likewise, there are certain shortcomings in his vision. So he mentioned this to the Buddha. And then Buddha himself mentioned that I too had the same problem while I was preparing to become the Buddha. I was a Bodhisattva at that time, and I too faced the same problem. Now Buddha is explaining his own experience. And again, the interesting point is that he is mentioning very interesting points which are influential to generating this samadhi. Sometimes we think that during the meditation actually we have to do everything, but according to this discussion we can see that there are various other influential factors which are causing the samadhi, causing the proper generation of samadhi. Now here the clairvoyance. Now the Buddha starts with what you call doubt. He mentioned if there is one have doubt, then it is very difficult to have proper concentration, because one's mind is doubtful, it is not fixed. And for the concentration, one has to have a very unwavering mind, fairly steady mind. But if one has doubt, then actually it causes to have kind of a wavering mind, doubtful mind. So as a result of that, you are not getting the proper samadhi. So Buddha mentioned that as the first reason, and one reason that we have the samadhi being hindered. And then Buddha keep on to various other factors. Then he talks about sloth and torpor, where one's mind become little lethargic, drowsy. On such situation also one can't continue one's practice. And then another point is fear. If one's mind is filled with fear, there are various kind of fearful thoughts are coming, interrupting. Then again, you can't maintain the proper samadhi, because your mind is not fully relaxed. Various kinds of distractions happen because of the fear. So that is also something that Buddha mentioned here. And it is again an upakilesa, kind of a drawback to this concentration. So it's a kind of an imperfection to this concentration. And then Buddha continue explaining various other imperfections. Then he mentioned about elation. Sometimes when things are going well, everything is successful, so one can become really elated. Then one loses the balance. So typically the more mature balance approach is the equanimous approach, when the mind is fairly equanimous, even though the things are successful or even though the things are unsuccessful. If one can maintain a balanced mind, so that would be the most appropriate kind of mental set, mindset. But here the Buddha mentioned that if one, due to some kind of a success, if one get elated, then one is losing the balance. So here he give an interesting simile. One is looking for a treasure and hidden treasure, and he was searching for an entrance. Immediately he find not just one entrance, he found five entrances. So as a result of that, he get really elated and he loses the temper, he loses the balance. So this is an example that Buddha gave for this elation. And then Buddha mentioned about inertia. Inertia is here basically the bodily inertia, because mind is mind fairly dependent on the bodily inertia, the bodily weariness. If body is fairly lethargic, if body can't move actively, then that actually has kind of a influence towards the mind. Say for example, if you had a heavy meal, after that if you immediately try to sit, then most probably you can't have same amount of concentration or a kind of weariness of the mind, and your mind may be also get into sloth and torpor, because the body doesn't active, it has some kind of an inertia. Similarly, if you are suffering with some kind of phlegm related disease, so that also makes the body fairly lethargic and not active. On such situation also, you might feel drowsy, you might feel lethargic, you might feel sloth and torpor. The mind represents sloth and torpor because the body also is not active. So that is something that we need to look into before meditation. So that is why we sometimes recommend having a walking meditation, because during the walking meditation you have to fairly actively participate in the sense you have to walk, purposely walk, intentionally you have to walk, and that walk also is not that very slow walk, rather it may be the natural speed that you have to maintain. On such situation, body can become fairly active, wieldy. So then you can sit, and then you can actually refine your mindfulness, refine your attention, refine your concentration, and refine your wisdom. But preparing the body, making it fairly energetic, wieldy, efficient. So these are certain factors that we need to think. So that is why particularly walking meditation is very, very important. And then last time we stopped very much here about talking about excess energy and deficiency of energy. So energy is another factor that we have to control properly. At the beginning we may have to put lot of effort because the hindrances are so powerful and distractions are very powerful. As a result of that, we need lot of effort. Say we are using the labeling, we are using the naming, so that also indicate fair amount of energy. We are putting some energy to the process so that the mental process is fairly in line with the bodily process. We are using some bodily process like breathing, rising and falling, various sensations, etc. to keep the mind engaged in the present moment. So at the beginning, so this is very much the practice one is trying. So when one is doing it, fair amount of energy is required, because if you are not putting enough energy, then your mind gets distracted. So again and again you have to note, you have to mentally note what is really going on, and so that noting actually helps to makes the mind fairly focused. Now the interesting point is, as you are continuing the practice, if you are maintaining the same amount of energy, so that very energy can become a distraction, or that very energy can become a cause of restlessness in the mind. Excess energy causes restlessness. So that is the law actually we need to remember. So while continuing our practice, we need to be aware of the situation of the mind. Time to time we need to step back and look at the mind, checking how mind is progressing. Is it continuing in a favorable manner, or is it having certain deficiency, any kind of inertia? So that kind of a thing that we need to again and again reflect. So that is actually the mindfulness. So if you have enough mindfulness, so that mindfulness will show us what is the state of the mind. So if the mindfulness is telling, okay, now mind is fairly calm, fairly tamed, then it's an indication that you need to reduce the energy. You need to balance the energy. If you are put excess energy, then actually you can't maintain the balance. So that excess energy causes the mind to distract, mind to become restless. Sometimes it is very difficult to understand because we are trying hard. So that is what we believe. If we put fair amount of energy, then only we will become successful. So that is what we believe. But unfortunately, when the mind is fairly calm, relaxed, if we are putting too much energy, it causes restlessness. Now the very cause which was helpful to our meditation, that is the effort, is now making a kind of a turbulence in the mind. So that we need to very clearly understand, and if one understands that properly, then step by step you need to reduce the energy. Sometimes if we immediately reduce energy, then again mind get sometimes lethargic, drowsy, because you are not putting enough energy. And if you are putting excess energy, the mind becomes restless. So this is a kind of a delicate balance that one needs to recognize during the meditation process. It's a very practical point. So even though I am telling the point here, you yourself have to apply this practical point during your meditation. You can't do it beforehand or after the situation. While you are continuing your practice, you need to be aware what is the state of the mind. If the mind is fairly relaxed, tamed, focused, then of course you need to reduce the energy so that you are only maintaining the situation. If you put too much energy, you can't continue. You may end up with restlessness. And if you put very, very less energy, then that also not the proper way, because that will cause kind of a lethargic, drowsy atmosphere in the mind. So therefore, this beautiful balance is something that the yogi has to practically learn. So you might not be able to immediately learn that, immediately recognize this necessary amount of energy. So you may have to go through a lot of trial and error procedures, and then only you may recognize, okay, this is the amount of energy I need to have. Now Buddha actually give a interesting simile also here. So he mentioned that if one is catching a quail, and if he is strongly sort of holding it, gripping it using the both hands, the quail might die because you are putting too much energy, you are putting too much kind of a grip. On the other hand, if you are not holding properly, not putting enough grip, then the quail may fly off because you are not properly holding it. So therefore, maintaining that proper balance is something that we need to practically learn. And then Buddha get on to another upakkilesa, imperfection. So there Buddha mentioned longing arose in me. So sometimes when we are continuing our practice, as we get a result, suppose in this case, assume that you are having a good concentration. So when you have good concentration, our mind get attached to that concentration. because it is the result that we acquired with lot of effort, lot of hard work. And once we got the result, there's a fair amount of inclination, fair amount of attachment towards that concentration, particularly in the samatha practice. So these concentrations are very, very blissful at the early stages. So those are therefore very, very attractive. So then what you do is you sit and expect that kind of a bliss in the next sitting as well. So that very expectation become a hindrance. I think you all have these kind of experiences. So whenever the practice becomes successful, we are enjoying it. And as we discussed earlier stage, we probably even get elated by that. And now you have a strong desire to the result, and you are expecting that kind of a success on the next sitting or next session as well. So this is the longing that we can have in the practice. And not only that, I mean, there may be various other even insights. Now assume that you are continuing your insight practice, and assume that there is a very interesting insight arisen, eye-opening insight arisen in you, and you are really enjoyed that, or you are really appreciated that insight, and you want to keep it and you want to have it forever. Actually, it is necessary to keep it, and actually it is necessary to maintain it as much as possible. We need to make use of it. But if we have kind of an attachment, too much attachment to that, then that very attachment causes it to kind of fade away, and to not to have it again at the next time. Because then our next sitting would be more oriented towards kind of a craving. So if the mind is craving, you can't get the same result. So here, particularly in the Vipassana, one has to have a very balanced, detached mind. Then only the results would come. Insights are possible only in a kind of a detached mind, not in a grasping mind. But when the kind of a desire is available, when kind of a longing is available, kind of a greed is available, so we are maintaining the opposite conditions. Not the conducive conditions, but the opposite. As a result of that, you can't continue the practice. You may end up with maybe a kind of frustration because you are not getting the result. Even though you are really desiring that result, you are not getting it. So your mind get this kind of unsatisfied, frustrated because of that. So therefore, even though we are kind of in a spiritual quest, during the practice we need to have a very balanced mind. So that is what the whole different points are highlighting. So all these different distractions, all these different imperfections are making the mind unbalanced. But if you are recognize these all different imperfections when they are available, so we have to be quite skillful to keep them aside, so that mind has that balance. Then the balanced mind, equanimous mind, is capable of generating more and more insights. And here the next point Buddha mentioned is the perception of diversity. Now here actually fairly related to the practice when Buddha is focusing here. He's teaching Venerable Anuruddha about the clairvoyance, Dibba Chakku. So during that kind of a practice, if you see so many things, so then that very vision can become a kind of a distraction. Because there are many things available, and your mind immediately get attracted to different those things, and you are seeing them vividly. And therefore they are quite attractive, and you get distracted because of that. So the result of the practice itself can become a distraction. Actually, sometimes this happens even in the Vipassana. Suppose while you are continuing your practice, assume that you are able to maintain a very quiet mind. Suppose you are in the walking meditation, and you are able to maintain a quiet mind. And while continuing, say you are practicing Dhatu Manasikara, Elements Meditation, or you are practicing, say, Vedana Anupassana, practice of the feelings, mindfulness on feeling, and or even you are simply watching the mind, recognizing various distractions. Suppose as you are continuing in the walking, suppose immediately a very interesting insight arises. Then what happens is, so that insight, once you are recognized, now you start thinking. You start thinking how it is mentioned in the book and how it is being mentioned by a particular monk, how it is mentioned in another book, how it is mentioned by another monk. So likewise, now mind start in a way proliferating, and ultimately mind becomes fairly distracted because so many things are getting into the picture. Actually, previously your mind was fairly focused and you are simply maintaining a mind free from inner chatter. There is no diversity. The mind is fairly very much like unified. But now the situation is mind has so many things, so many distractions, so many things to look at. So ultimately mind get distracted. So therefore the diversity can not only happen in the Samatha meditation, even it can happen in the Vipassana meditation. So there may be various areas which is producing diversified results. Many objects are available. Now even say for example you are trying to look at the body and various sensations are available. Many sensations are available sometimes. It is not just one sensation, but many sensations are available. And you can't recognize which one you are going to pay attention, because all appear like fairly significant. So which one are you going to select in order to investigate? So that decision you have to make quickly, otherwise the available concentration might get faded away, because now you can recognize so many sensations here and there, so many sensations are available. So in order to continue the practice, probably you need to recognize most prominent sensation, but since many sensations are available, you are unable to immediately select one. So this is also something can happen. And again, assume that you are doing Chittanupassana, and sometimes mind experience so many thoughts one after the other, or sometimes they are coming even overlapped each other. So many thoughts are there. So if you are trying to recognize one by one, then it is very difficult, because they are very very much overlapped. Then it's difficult to recognize each one of them. Now this diversity can become a kind of an imperfection in such situation. So what are we going to do? Probably we better relax. So rather than we are trying to recognize all these different information, different thoughts, different sensations, or different whatever the elements, so we need to step back and little relax and see how mind react. So probably you can remember Buddha mentioned about how to balance 7 enlightenment factors, and there Buddha mentioned 3 groups. Actually, the one group is fairly activating the mind, and another group is fairly calming down the mind, and the other group simply have one factor, that is the mindfulness, which is simply doing the monitoring part, balancing part. So once mindfulness is telling us, okay, this part is excess and we need to reduce it, once mindfulness is telling us this part is lacking, then you need to increase it. So likewise, when we are continuing our practice, if there are too much of information is available, and if we can't handle it properly, then it can become a distraction. And even the information may be very distinct and very interesting, then our attention being drawn to that result, then ultimately we lose the balance. And then Buddha mentioned as another imperfection, this is the 11th one, excessive meditation upon forms arose in me. Now once the result is available, now here as we know we are talking about clairvoyance. Clairvoyance expect fair amount of vision. I mean, using light you are now trying to see various forms, and now one gets it. And once you get it, you are overusing it. And you are excessively meditating, excessively now continuing your practice, because you are really thrilled by the practice, and now you are practicing more and more. But ultimately, the body can become really tired, mind can become really tired, because you don't know the balance. We need to understand that this practice is a kind of a continuous process. If you are putting too much of it, that itself can become a cause of distraction, cause of failure. So sometimes I know that certain yogis, so they come to a retreat, say 5 days retreat, and they are putting fairly high energy and even not bothered about maintaining the body. They are not having enough food or even not having enough sleep, and they are practicing so hard, but ultimately they can't maintain it. Ultimately body become really tired because you are putting too much energy and too much practice. So we need to find out what is the balance, how many hours that we can practice, how long that we can practice. So it's a kind of a balance approach we again have to maintain here. If we, whenever we are becoming successful, sometimes if we put too much energy and if we are not maintaining the other necessary conducive factors, so ultimately the whole thing collapse, whole thing can become failure. So here Buddha continue talking about the concentration. Here he mentioned sometimes he perceive light, but sometimes the forms are not visible, and sometimes he see forms but not enough light is available, and sometimes limited light is available. As a result of that, he see limited forms, and sometimes immeasurable light is available. As a result of that, immeasurable forms are visible. So then he understand, okay, for the successful vision, so he need to have kind of a balance. So if he has excessive light and too much information, too much forms, then might not be easy to handle by the mind. But if he has very less light, then the information is less, then that is also not sufficient. So there Buddha now talks about the clairvoyance, how he has balanced that. And particularly now he is mentioning, so the concentration in this samatha practice is a must. And typically we consider that one has to have all the jhanas to have clairvoyance. And as I mentioned last time, discussing this sutta does not mean that we are going to develop clairvoyance. I am not encouraging you to develop clairvoyance, but rather the theme of this sutta is to understand what are the imperfections available for the concentration. I mean, it is not only in the samatha practice, even in the vipassana practice, as we are continuing, there may be various distractions happen, various imperfections happen, and probably we can't immediately understand what is the cause. So the discussion of this sutta is to understand those remote causes which is not evident. Sometimes we can't immediately understand these causes, whether they are really influential. But according to this teaching in this sutta, we can understand actually these are also influencing our practice, like doubt, sotantopa, say fear, excess energy or less energy, elation, having too much information, and you are sometimes too attached to the result. So likewise, very subtle imperfections are there. So that actually ultimately makes a huge impact into our practice, and ultimately we even can fail. Now after Buddha mentioning this, so he mentioned that ultimately he was successful, he was able to handle everything properly, and ultimately he was quite successful in having clairvoyance, and he may be continuing in his vipassana practice as well, and ultimately he become the Buddha. And actually there are very few other suttas attached to this. So this Upakkilesa Sutta particularly emphasize on the upakkilesas, the imperfections, but certain other suttas are there related to the same incident. Say, for example, in the Majjhima Nikaya, there's another sutta called Chula Gosinga Sutta. So after receiving the instructions from the Buddha, now Venerable Anuruddha, Venerable Nandiya, Venerable Kimbila, so they are continuing their practice. And another occasion, they were living at Chula Gosinga forest. So there also the same incident happened. That means Buddha again arrived them and visit them, and the gatekeeper or the park owner simply refused his giving permission, and Venerable Anuruddha come to the picture, and the same thing has happened. And at that time, actually, all these three venerables are fairly developed. Actually, they were already arahants. And you can see in this particular incident, what we just discussed in the Upakkilesa Sutta, they are still continuing their practice. They are not arahants. But we can see in the Chula Gosinga Sutta, when Buddha interact with them and Buddha ask information about them, discuss about their practice, all of them actually mention about their practice, about their success, and indicate now they are completely free from any defilement. And they even have all these three, what you call the abhinya, the direct knowledges. And it's therefore a kind of a continuation is available in the Chula Gosinga Sutta. And Buddha actually praised them, because now they actually lived really harmoniously. They were looking each other with kind eyes. They were helping each other. They were maintaining very good loving kindness towards each one. And again, they are practicing diligently. They understood the Buddha's instructions in the Upakkilesa Sutta, what is mentioned. And accordingly, they were practicing further properly, diligently. And ultimately, they were able to become arahants. So Buddha praised them. And even Buddha, there's another people who also get to know that they are arahants. There is one general of Yakkas, it is mentioned in the Chula Gosinga Sutta. So he become very appreciative about these three venerables, and he come to the Buddha and he mentioned about the about these three venerables. And likewise, so we can see, so when these monks are living harmoniously, it becomes a blessing to everyone. It is not just them who is benefiting, but there are many others getting the benefit. Others are getting a very interesting example, very good example from their living, harmonious living. And they generate a lot of, wholesome mind by looking at it. And as a result of that, in the Chula Gosinga Sutta, it is mentioned how their reputation being spreaded even to the, celestial beings, even to the Brahma realms. So their reputation being spread. And then Buddha mentioned, I mean, if someone is helping them, someone is sort of giving alms to them, so it's a great blessing to them. Even looking at them, even thinking about them, reflecting about them, becomes a great blessing to the people. So likewise, Buddha praised these three venerables when they are fairly successful. And that is actually mentioned in the Chula Gosinga Sutta, how these three venerables have become arahants. So that is something additional to the Upakkilesa Sutta. Basically, that wraps up the Upakkilesa Sutta. So with that, I like to stop this sutta teaching today. Now I like to open the session for questions.
Thank you, Bante. Sadhu. For anyone that's joining us for the first time, you may ask questions by raising your hand, or you can also send them via the chat.
So today also I am little close to a school. Probably you can hear our national anthem being played in the background.
Yes, Bante.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to invite Joseph to ask our question.
Thank you, Jennifer. Hello, Bante.
Yes.
Hello, I wanted to mention that I had been applying what we had talked about a couple of weeks ago in the Samadhi Bhavana Sutta, and I just wanted to mention how I found that very helpful.
Right.
So what I've been noticing is when I sit, usually I'll do about 30 minutes of walking to sort of, when I wake up, to kind of, I guess, wake up. You know, I feel like that's the best thing to do. And then within about 30 minutes, I feel fairly clear-minded. So then I just sit. I find that almost right away, as soon as I sit down, my mind is fairly clear, and I sort of notice whatever, I would say, kind of like the breath is fairly subtle, and then I don't really look for another object. I kind of just sort of just present without necessarily having an object of a primary object that's really present or obvious. And then if I notice a distraction, I'll try and label it. For example, if the distraction is doubt, I can fairly label it. Oh, okay, that was a doubt. And then I will think, well, that's the lack of sustained thought, which is the way I understood it. And then I will kind of look more to the breath again to see if I can sort of use that to counter the doubt, and that seems to work. Or if I'm feeling all of a sudden I have a thought and I realize, oh, that's ill will that I'm having, and I'll say, okay, well, that's a lack of the rapture. And even just noticing that, it seems like just the noticing of it is enough that it kind of goes away, and then there's the rapture, there's the kind of the goosebumps or the kind of, you know, the feeling of like a sort of a massage kind of feeling. And it seems to happen just with the labeling. And even with I'll notice, oh, this is me, I'm thinking past and future. This is the worry and the regret, and that there's the lack of sukha, the lack of contentness, and that also seems to kind of evaporate. And, with the wandering mind or the sensual desire, that is the lack of the one-pointed concentration, and that also, it just seems to kind of, I just wanted, I guess, to say it was very, very helpful as a kind of a method or a technique for me to really maintain a equanimous state by having that method of those opposites from that particular sutta. I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, thank you. Actually, as you said, recognizing the state of the mind is one requirement. So the mindfulness is the one which is very much monitoring our mind. So the after going through that monitoring process, mindfulness will tell us, okay, this is what is happening. As you said, there may be little restlessness, there may be little rust, there may be little ill will. So likewise, time to time, some shades of different defilements may be present. So we may recognize them. We may feel them, or we may understand their presence. So once they are there, so different options are available. So as you said, understanding, say, ill will is there, now you can understand, okay, that is because I don't have enough piti, about enough rapture available. And then slowly we are maybe generating a little bit of rapture, so that then one is maintaining that, one is able to have again a balanced mind. So, as you said, if this kind of restlessness available, probably as we discussed, it can be due to imperfection of excess energy. Or maybe because of some frustration happening, because that we are expecting too much of results. So likewise, I mean, sometimes it is straightforward to understand the reason, and sometimes it is not that straightforward, because so sometimes the result, the reason is evident, and sometimes it is not evident. Like in the Upakkilesa Sutta, the whole thing that Buddha points out is that Venerable Anuruddha seems still unable to understand all these imperfections time to time appear in the picture, but Buddha himself, understanding them before his enlightenment, he was able to handle it. Now he is instructing Venerable Anuruddha, so these kind of imperfections may be available. As I mentioned, one difficulty in the imperfection is that they are showing some different picture, showing some kind of disguised picture. Say for example, lust can arise in disguise as say metta, as loving kindness. So you are generating fair amount of loving kindness, but underneath there could be kind of a lust. Similarly, you may be doing some kind of a thinking, a little bit of analysis, rational thinking and all these things, thinking it is the wisdom, but underneath that it could be doubt. So likewise, these upakkilesas, imperfections, are little tricky in a way. So you can't immediately understand their operation, and they are very much like hidden. Someone else is in the front, but underneath is an upakkilesa. So that is the main thing that we need to understand, that certain defilements are straightforward. Say if the mind is lustful, immediately we can understand it is lustful. If the mind is filled with ill will, we can understand, okay, it is the ill will. Because defilements are defilements, and if you know exactly it is a defilement, this particular defilement, then it is easy to understand.
It's more obvious.
More obvious, yeah. Exactly, more obvious. But sometimes it is very tricky. So what we have in the outer appearance may be like maybe loving kindness, maybe like wisdom, maybe like investigation. So likewise, if we continue that, probably there may be doubts happening, there may be restlessness happening, there may be lust happening. So likewise, mind may turn towards something else. So at the very early stage, if you are able to understand, okay, even though it appear like loving kindness, it could be due to kind of a influence coming from lust, and if I have a desire, so that desire is the one promoting and ultimately manifesting as loving kindness. So if we are able to recognize that kind of a tricky deceiving nature available in the mind, then we can handle it quickly without promoting it. So likewise, it's very interesting in a way, very 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 interesting how our mind is operating. So it is sometimes quite straightforward to understand these defilements, but sometimes they are not.
And it seems that the mind is extremely, it can make things so quickly.
Exactly.
So just with just such ease, it's kind of mind-blowing to, mm-hmm. to see how quickly the mind can craft whatever it likes.
Exactly.
And create a picture, a very convincing picture, like very, very like lightning, quickly making associations.
Yes.
And building it, making it so attractive.
Right.
It's very, it's quite something. Yeah. And I guess maybe as a final question, just to make sure that I'm still practicing correctly, I'm just going with this being without a particular object, just
right.
sort of being there.
Right.
And I guess I sometimes still kind of wonder, should I be doing more vipassana? Should I be taking an object and examining it, or is it really just being there, just mm-hmm. sitting there, and is that really
fruitful?
I mean, is that all there? mean,
yeah.
Sometimes I feel that I should be doing...
Do something, yeah.
I should be doing something,
mm-hmm.
like that maybe I should be getting a jhana, or mm-hmm. I should be... at the same time, I feel that it's... I'm very equanimous.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very at home.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder if I should be grappling with something, and maybe that is just the craving. So I would like
Correct.
To ask you your thoughts on that.
Yeah, actually, when we are approaching this stage, the behavior of the mind has to be very carefully recognized, and it's a kind of a delicate practice now we have. It is not, as you said, unlike in the previous stages. I mean, it is not the strong defilements available now. I mean, your mind may not have lust, may not have anger, may not have jealousy. So likewise, the strong defilements are absent now. And that is why the calmness is available, and even there is not even a thought in the mind. So even the mind is completely free from any association, any grasping. And at that time, the arising of defilements may happen very slowly. I mean, we can't say immediately one after the other defilements are happening, but time to time, say for example, eye making can happen, mind making can happen, I am can happen, because these are very, very subtle. Because they are happening not only in the during the practice. I mean, these defilements have no mercy for us. So it is their appearance during our practice session may be very less, because we are ready. But they overpower us or even overwhelm us during the other occasions. Now, therefore, our practice has to be kind of a ongoing practice. It is not just limited to a particular time now. Rather, throughout the day, we have to be vigilant. What is really going on in the mind? So it's a kind of a very kind of an ongoing process, kind of a parallel process continuously going on. Even though we are engaged with some certain other activity, we need to look at the mind, how it is behaving. Is it, now say for example, say you are discussing a particular matter with someone. Say, now he is telling this and that and all these things, and slowly a little bit of anger can arise in you. Or slowly maybe a little bit of restlessness or sort of irritation can arise in you. Or sometimes even that you want to govern the situation, you want to impose your own ideas onto the picture. I mean, maybe if you are to give your proper advice, that is fine, but at that time also we can see when we are trying to communicate our idea, so are we doing it properly? Are we doing it in a way with some defilement? Say I can have a lot of conceit, I can have a lot of ego, and I can put my idea into the picture. So I can diplomatically put my idea to the picture, so that there is no eye making happens. Because sometimes when we are reacting to a situation, there is a lot of sense of I can generate. Now say for example, when one feels really angry, so that is a strong time where I is present. So your mind become very active, your I-ness is very strong, you feel a lot of ego. So that is where you are manifesting as an individual. But in the long run, so that kind of strong presence of I has to become less and less. So therefore, I feel continuing the practice so that is fairly incorporated to our whole life is something that we need to look into. And again, time to time, we have to allow the mind to completely rest and just relax. And that relaxation also has to happen in the surface, not at the depth. What I mean here is now, say for example, if you have strong concentration, so that concentration can prevent any defilements to arise. On the other hand, if
it
you
feels, it feels, it feels that way.
Exactly.
I can feel that there's a like a defilement kind of arising, but it's very muted, and I can feel that it, that the mind isn't going like that. What I talked about or just mentioned, how the mind quickly turns it into a picture and builds it, that it's not going to happen.
Right.
And yet, yes. So it feels like there's a wall. And or like a big like I've got big earmuffs on,
right,
or something, and that the defilement is not, I can't hear it, kind
right.
of.
Yeah, but yeah. The other thing is, now assume that you are simply living in the surface, not in a kind of a concentrated state. Your mind is very much in the more natural state. So at that time, there's a higher probability for this defilement to appear, and they can even influence. Because you are not having that cover or that sheath coming from the concentration.
Right.
So therefore, so one aspect of vipassana is that to reduce concentration and see whether your mind is capable of maintaining that calmness, maintaining that purity. Say you had a fair amount of concentration because of that. Assume that the mind is preventing or not getting any kind of defilements, but immediately you are reducing the strength of the concentration, there may be a possibility that various defilements can arise. So therefore, it's very much like now we are assume that we are able to capture a stronghold. So probably, probably we are still not protected. There may be enemies still around. But later, but after some time, assume that all the enemies are gone or destroyed, whatever things, then we can freely move because no enemies are available. So something like that. So when the defilements are fairly defeated, fairly removed or fairly faded away, then we can freely move. We don't need to even maintain any kind of concentration, but the concentration become kind of a inbuilt characteristic, very much like. So your mind has the clarity always. It is not that you are purposely, effortfully maintaining the clarity of mind, but the clarity of mind has become the manifestation of the samadhi. Now, you know, the samadhi has various appearances or various shades. At the beginning, it may manifest as a kind of a concentration, kind of focus, attention, so that you are able to focus your attention onto a particular phenomena and you are able to properly understand that. So that may be one aspect of concentration. And at another occasion, there may be a kind of a concentration which is kind of a little diversified. There you are able to understand many, many phenomena and you are in a kind of a big picture. And there may be another occasion where there is no object at all, but simply the field of awareness is available and the clarity of mind is available, and that itself becomes the concentration. It is not, we can't say it have a kind of a concentration. We can say it's a kind of collectedness of mind. So it is not getting distracted even though there is no object to recognize, but the mind is not distracted. Now this is again a very mature level of concentration, and we better call it maybe collectedness of the mind, and it's a kind of a awareness actually, but there are no objects maybe, and even objects are coming, simply we are aware of them and then simply they will pass by. We are able to maintain that field of awareness, and that is very much a clarity of mind, but it is a very relaxed state. So likewise, we need to gradually reach that kind of a very relaxed, effortless kind of a state where the clarity of the mind is maintained, but with less effort.
That's very helpful. I appreciate your time. Thank you, Bhante.
Yeah.
Everyone, Saranai.
Yeah, everyone, Saranai.
Thank you. That was a very helpful Q&A. Are there any more questions feel free to raise your hand, or you can also send via the chat. We have a very quiet group today, Bante.
Yes, yes. Very good. So actually, I was in a little noisy environment, so now I am experiencing little quietude in that as well. So
yeah.
So things are changing.
Yes, constantly, always.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, if there is no any other question, probably then we can wind up the session, and probably we can take up another sutta at another time. And actually, I like to add a few more points to the same Upaklesa Sutta. So these three venerables, as I mentioned, are very say prominent arahants, and Venerable Anuruddha particularly have become the foremost in the clairvoyance, and he was able to recognize various visions, and he is the one actually properly understood how Buddha passed away. Now this is interestingly mentioned in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, how he was understanding the different stages of the Parinibbana of the Buddha. And sometimes actually Venerable Ananda thought Buddha has already passed away and informed that to the Venerable Anuruddha. And then Venerable Anuruddha mentioned, no, no, still he is in this particular Samadhi, still he is in this particular Jhana. And likewise, he was recognizing, investigating how Buddha's mind was going through this Parinibbana process, the passing away process during his last Parinibbana. And ultimately, he mentioned that Buddha was able to go through all these states, and ultimately even he bore the kind of physical pain happened during the process. Because you know the body is dying now. So when the body is dying, so there could be a significant pain coming through that process. And he mentioned that how Buddha very cleverly, equanimously, how Buddha bear that pain coming from the body, and ultimately he passed away. So this is the Venerable Anuruddha who explained that. And he's the one actually in the first council handled the Anguttara Nikaya. You know, Venerable Kassapa was the kind of questioner who is leading the thing. Venerable Ananda basically is the one answering various questions related to the certain other suttas. And Venerable Upali is the one continuing about the Vinaya. Venerable Anuruddha is the one who is assigned to maintain Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses of the Buddha. And according to the information, he has lived a long life. He lived 150 years. And he also is from Sakyan family. And he's actually a relative of the Buddha. So he too is a Sakyan family. So a Sakyan, and he's a very beautiful person. Therefore, there is an interesting incident happened in the Vinaya Pitaka, where after he became an arahant, one woman actually was interested about him, and she invited him for almsgiving, and he entered her house, and she tried to tempt Venerable Anuruddha. Actually, she seems to be a prostitute. Anyway, Venerable Anuruddha was not interested. And ultimately, he came out, and actually, this woman was very much understood that Venerable Anuruddha is not a person that she can tempt. And ultimately, she became a devotee of Venerable Anuruddha. And anyway, Venerable Anuruddha came and explained the situation to the Buddha, and that caused to have one Vinaya rule established. So therefore, Venerable Anuruddha is one arahant which has caused one Vinaya rule to be established. So Buddha actually put a kind of a Vinaya rule where a monk should not live in privately with a woman. So So here actually Venerable Anuruddha was fortunate, he is an arahant, so he could handle the situation. But if a typical ordinary monk living in a private space with a woman, so then it can cause a lot of problem, I mean privately to him as well as to the others. Others are generating a lot of doubts and all these difficult situations can happen. So as a result of that, Buddha put a lay down a particular rule. So that is also an interesting incident. And Venerable Nandiya and Venerable Kimbila are also two arahants, and they are what you call this Theragatha are also available in the Kuddaka Nikaya. So they too are prominent arahants, and those are the little things that I like to add as the end of the sutta. And with that, I like to conclude today's sutta teaching session. So we have spent fair amount of time listening to Dhamma, and again we spent some time in discussing Dhamma and all the merits that we have accrued. Let's share with all the past relatives, with all the celestial beings and whoever in need of merits. And we wish these merits help us also to attain path fruition Nibbana. While keeping these good wishes in our mind, let's recite the traditional verses. එතාවතා චම්හෙහි සම්බතං පුඤ්ඤ සම්පදං සබ්බේ දේවා අනුමෝදන්තු සබ්බ සම්පත්ති සිද්ධියා එතාවතා චම්හෙහි සම්බතං පුඤ්ඤ සම්පදං සබ්බේ භූතා අනුමෝදන්තු සබ්බ සම්පත්ති සිද්ධියා එතාවතා චම්හෙහි සම්බතං පුඤ්ඤ සම්පදං සබ්බේ සත්තා අනුමෝදන්තු සබ්බ සම්පත්ති සිද්ධියා ආකාසට්ටාජ බුම්මට්ටා දේවානාගා මහිද්දිිකා පුඤ්ඤන්තං අනුමෝදිත්වා චිරං රක්ඛන්තු සාසනං ආකාසට්ටාජ බුම්මට්ටා දේවානාගා මහිද්දිිකා පුඤ්ඤන්තං අනුමෝදිත්වා චිරං රක්ඛන්තු දේශනං ආකාසට්ටාජ බුම්මට්ටා දේවානාගා මහිද්දිිකා පුඤ්ඤන්තං අනුමෝදිත්වා චිරං රක්ඛන්තු මම් පරං ඉදං වෝ ඥාතීනං හෝතු සුඛිතා හුන්තු ඥාතයෝ ඉදං වෝ ඥාතීනං හෝතු සුඛිතා හුන්තු ඥාතයෝ ඉදං වෝ ඥාතීනං හෝතු සුඛිතා හුන්තු ඥාතයෝ ඉමිනා පුඤ්ඤ කම්මේන මාමේ බාල සමාගමෝ සතං සමාගමෝ හෝතු යාව නිබ්බාන පත්තියා ඉමිනා පුඤ්ඤ කම්මේන මාමේ බාල සමාගමෝ සතං සමාගමෝ හෝතු යාව නිබ්බාන පත්තියා ඉමිනා පුඤ්ඤ කම්මේන මාමේ බාල සමාගමෝ සතං සමාගමෝ හෝතු යාව නිබ්බාන පත්තියා සාදු සාදු සාදු